This is The Uprising, starring Steve Alquist. I'm your host, Greg Brailsford. Today, Senator Tiara Mack joins us as we discuss policing in America and the Ocean State. Steve, happy Monday. How you doing today?
Well, honestly, I'm pissed, and I'll tell you why. On Friday, the police had a press conference about Jamal Gonzalez, the Providence Police Department, Stephen Perret, Chief Clements, and as has happened many times in the past, at least three times in the past, Uprise Rhode Island was not invited to this press conference. We were left off the list. And so I found out about it 20 minutes into the middle of this press conference happening, and I was already well on my way into Massachusetts. I was in a completely wrong direction. I had to pull over the car and listen to the press conference on the side of the road on Facebook because I was not invited. Now, had I been known about this, I could easily have rescheduled my stuff, made some changes, been there, still made all my rest of my day. But I can only believe now that the Providence Police Department is intentionally leaving Uprise Rhode Island off their press list for certain things on purpose.
And that's ironic because we're here doing an episode today on policing and their conduct and how it's unbecoming of police. And here we are with a example of that, a petty example of that, mind you, where the police are intentionally leaving us off of a press list because they know that we'll report the straight shoot on what happened and what's going down. And perhaps the other news stations maybe might be a little more polite about it. Maybe. That's the only thing I can take away from it. What do you think?
I have to say, like, when I report on the police, like, let's say the Jamal Gonzalez case, which is the case of a 24-year-old man who was run down by police officers and sent into a coma. Very, very bad. Lots of things going on with that. We can talk about details later if you like. But when you talk about that, I write about that incident pretty neutrally. I use the police reports. I use the police statements. Then I listen to what the activists are saying and what the critics are saying. And I give them a voice as well. But I haven't taken any firm stances here. I'm out there covering the protests. I'm giving them a voice. I don't turn around and say, this is why the police are lying per se. I mean, if someone else wants to make that claim, they can. But I'm not making those judgments in my writing anyway. Right? My personal views may be different, but in the writing and the reporting I'm doing, I'm always right on. And I'll have to tell you, Chief Clements once said to me, he thinks my reporting is fair and honest. So if the chief can admit that my reporting is fair and honest, right, even if he doesn't like it all the time, then you really can't criticize what I'm trying to do here. And I think leaving me off the list, leaving me out of these press conferences is really just a way of making sure that the uncomfortable questions aren't posed at these press conferences.
That seems to exactly be it because, you know, I've been with you for a while now and I read every article that you publish, every article that we publish, and especially the ones about policing. And I don't see a bias there in our reporting. I think that police and perhaps right-wingers believe that we have a bias against police because we cover so many of these stories. Whereas, you know, the other news stations and news organizations in Rhode Island may not cover them. And so it appears that, you know, police are doing an okay job or they didn't, you know, mess this up or do something wrong because it was only covered by Uprise. And and that's what I'm getting. That seems to be the vibe that I'm getting from this is that they know that we're going to come at them and ask them real questions and not be softballs.
Well, I think the question about police isn't necessarily about any one incident, right? We can talk about different incidences where the police have assaulted people or the police have, like, you know, maybe not criminally recklessly, but recklessly endangered people on the road or caused terrible accidents and all these other things. But the real question that we're trying to answer here, the real issue at the heart of this, and I think this is what society is debating with now, is what should policing look like? And is policing the way we do it necessary at all? Right? And so this is the heart of it. And this is the question that when we get to these like specific issues, we're really kind of asking questions about the wider scope. What is policing? What should it be? You know, is it an irrevocably racist institution that has to be abolished? A lot of people believe that. Is it something that could be reformed somehow? Well, attempts at reform have been not great. But on the other hand, maybe there is some way. Is it something that needs to be thrown away entirely and replaced with mental health concerns and, you know, I don't know, other types of interactions, right?
Right.
Community-based different interactions. I don't know what that looks like exactly. But, you know, I think people are starting to explore and talk about what that might look like. And, you know, at the very least, we can start to talk about these things. But if I'm not invited, if I'm not able to ask those questions of the people who are making these kind of decisions, and if activists are kept out of press conferences, and all you're going to get is the standard top tier TV stations, Projo, WPRO, and nobody else is going to be allowed in there, then you're going to get that story. You're going to get a story made to hit the middle class white voter right in their sweet spot. And you're going to say, bad thing happened, but it's okay. Just an accident. You know, things like this happen occasionally. You know, people die at Little League games occasionally for stupid reasons. So we're not about to ban baseball. So sure, one guy got run off his bike and he's in a coma. Maybe it's not a big deal, but there's more to it than that, right? There's a gigantic issue here, and we're trying to deal with what this means. What is it about? And I think that's what I'm trying to answer.
Yeah, and
that's
I think, what I'm getting at. And I think that, you know, you want to improve police relations. You know, if you're the police chief or the mayor or any person in leadership, maybe you might want to start at the very basics, like perhaps adding the press to your press list. They know that we're the press. We're every bit as journalistic as a Channel 10, Channel 12, or anyone else. And yet they know what they're going to get from Channel 10 or Channel 12. That's just the facts. You know, we love the reporters there, but that's just the fact. You're going to get a different type of story than you would get from Uprise RI. You know, we don't strive for access. You know, a lot of news organizations, whether it's nationwide or locally, they want access to politicians. And right. So in order to get that access and keep that access, they're nice to them. They don't ask the hard questions because, you know, if you're a Gina Raimondo and you know a news organization is going to ask you tough questions every time that you interview with them. Are you going to want to interview with them? Are you going to want to answer their questions at a press conference? No, probably not. I know our progressive legislators will absolutely do that. But when you're not progressive, when you're not always looking out for the people's best interests, you don't tend to want to answer those questions. And so that's what we do as an organization at Uprise. We try to ask the questions that you listeners and our readers want to know, because that's not always the case. A lot of these news organizations don't ask the hard questions.
And we don't ask gotcha questions. I'm not impolite at press conferences. I'm not like, you know, banging my fist or interrupting or saying, you know, I accuse you of this or anything. I ask questions.
You're absolutely right.
Right?
Absolutely right.
I don't really think that I've ever asked a question at a public press conference that I'm embarrassed by. I think I've always asked questions that I think are on point or clarifying, or they might not like the question or the direction of the question. But, you know, I mean, I go to the governor's press conferences occasionally, these COVID press conferences he does. And all the questions are about small business loans, and all the questions are about can we reopen school sports and all these other things that are very, I'm going to call them white middle-class questions, right? And I'm like saying, what about people being evicted? What about housing? What about people losing their homes? What about low-income workers who are forced to go to work, exposing themselves to COVID with no real protections besides masks and maybe a panel? Right? These are frontline workers. This is important, really, as a nurse. I mean, where do you get your prescription if you can't go to CVS to pick it up? And there's a person there working a counter who isn't a medical professional, maybe, who's just a person who works the counter at CVS. And here, and that person is putting themselves at risk for people who are sick coming in from medicine. Are they being properly treated? Are they being even properly paid by CVS, which pays minimum wage to a lot of people?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to representing your viewers. You know, I think that these other organizations that, frankly, they have to sell ads to survive.
Yes.
You know, we do not have to sell any ads to survive. Right. We've got a structure in place with me and Steve, where we can report on what we want to report on. If we don't have access, if we don't have advertisers, if we run a story that happens to, you know, piss off Verizon or someone like that, that's fine. Good for them. You know, if they're advertising with us and they want to stop, great, fine, no problem. And if not, then that's fine too. But it's important to have integrity when you report and to ask the right questions. And you'll notice when we have progressive legislators on that you know, myself and Steve agree on a lot of things with, we're still going to ask them questions that you want to know. Last episode, we had Aaron Regenberg on, and I asked him, progressives, rightfully so, dunk on the Democratic Party for incompetence, for not being a left party. And I asked him, you know, what stops you from running as an independent? You know, and it's a question that Democratic legislators are not super comfortable answering.
Right.
But it's a question that needs to be asked because it's not just me that wants to know. I mean, if you hop on Twitter, hop on Facebook, hundreds and hundreds of progressives are and activists are really, really upset with the Democratic Party. And so it was an important question to ask. And so, you know, we try to ask, you know, the questions that make sense. You know, and it may not be any hard questions for a particular legislator that we could think of. You know, there may just not be any. If that's the case, so be it. But we try to ask the questions that, you know, our listeners and our readers would be interested in. Well, anyway, it's just so much to cover today, and I want to get right into it.
Yeah, let's do it.
I have a feeling we'll be back to feature-length movie time for this episode as well. So for you guys that want a quick dose of us every week, sorry. We might be the hour-plus show today. But it's going to be a loaded show, guys. You're going to have a lot of fun. You're going to enjoy this one. We have a lot of really interesting things to talk about. We have a lot of information about policing that you may not be aware of. So hopefully you learned something from today. And let's start it off. So last Thursday,
yep.
We had Peter Nerones, the AG, issued a report on Jamal Gonsalves.
Yeah.
He was the ATV rider who was struck by a stop sign that was struck by a police officer, mm-hmm. putting him into a coma. And that report was released yesterday. There was a press conference that we just alluded to earlier that we were left out of.
Well, we went to that press conference. We went to the AG's press conference. We didn't go to the press conference this morning, Friday, which was the police department's press conference about the officers. There's two
Correct.
Different press conferences.
Correct. So the AG had a press conference yesterday.
Yeah.
And we were at that one.
Yep.
He was nice enough to let us know. And we went to that one and reported on it. Go
figure. It was
figure.
Very normal.
Yep. Yep. And then today, PPD, Providence Police, had their own press conference yep. to announce, I guess, sanctions or what have you against the officers or what their plans were yeah. or what have you. And they did not let us know about that, even though we are supposedly on their press list. They conveniently left us off of the announcement for this press conference. So what do you got? What do you got about Jamal Gonsalves? The report, everything. It's just very shocking to me.
Well, the report is interesting because what they released was everything. They released a report, which is like a 100-page accident reconstruction report, which talks about exactly second by second, even half second, and frame by frame, what happened by pulling together all the different video, by putting together forensic evidence. And what they determined was that Officer Kyle Andres pursued Jamal Gonsalves on his moped. When Jamal Gonsalves turned up a street, the officer's car briefly, I think, lost control. You can sort of see it in the dashboard. His camera, his hands like all over the place trying to take control. Hit a stop sign, which then hit Jamal in the helmet, and that put him into a coma. And if you look at the forensic evidence in the pictures, you can see a stop sign with bits of helmet like paint on it, and you can see a helmet with bits of stop sign paint on it. And it's very clear that he just got smacked hard. And if you think about the angular velocity, right, think about a baseball bat. When you swing a baseball bat and you move your arm moves whatever speed it does. The end of that baseball bat is moving way, way faster.
It is, yep.
This stop sign was hit by the bumper of a car. Tall stop sign, 6 feet tall, 8 feet tall, whatever. Low, maybe a foot off the ground. By the time that stop sign hit him in the head with the helmet, right? Think about how fast that must have been going. Right?
It was how many frames?
It's not even.
From like standing up to not to completely down.
It looks like one frame of
one
video.
Frame. Yeah.
It looks like that from what we can see. And it's really hard to see because it's really blurry, blown up video. But that thing must have been traveling, I don't even know, hundreds of miles an hour, 200 miles an hour when it hit him in the head. I don't even know because what's the calculation of an 18 mile an hour car hitting at 1 foot? And I'm sure somebody out there can do the math.
Yes. Do we have any scientific listeners here? If you could yeah. do that calculation for us.
Yeah, do that math. But you know, that hit him in the helmet that hard. Now, had he not been wearing a helmet, he might have been his brain would have been spattered.
Right.
Right. He would have been instantly killed. Helmet saved his life. And so now he's in a coma. That's how the accident happened. But more interesting than the reconstruction of the accident, we now know the police definitely caused the accident. It doesn't matter that the car didn't hit his moped. Car hit something that hit his moped. Same thing. So more interesting is Attorney General Nerona's legal analysis of the case. And he decided that it didn't rise to criminal recklessness on behalf of the officers. He analyzed the actions of the officers, the statements of the officers, the video of the cars, the way they moved. And he determined that though there may have been what he called civil negligence, there was no criminal recklessness. civil negligence is something you can sue over, but criminal recklessness is what would bring actual police charges. Is this definitely the case? That would be for other lawyers to decide and debate. Had he brought this case to trial, would he have won? I don't know. He chose not to bring it to trial, not to bring charges. The Federal Justice Department signed off on a report, meaning they're not going to do anything else. So there is no criminal charges going to be brought. That's the end of that. Now it's up to the family, who had a press conference shortly after that, which I was invited to. And the family is going to be launching a lawsuit perhaps next week. And the family is, of course, really disappointed by the findings of the AG as far as not bringing a criminal case.
Right. And so I got a couple of questions there. Yeah. First of all, what is Providence Police's policy, if you know it, on chasing suspects? Or
they're
chasing,
not,
and if you don't, if the person was even a suspect, chasing just in general?
Well, it's interesting. Way, way back when this case first broke, Commissioner Perret, who heads the public safety complex and is in charge of the police, he said that they were not there to chase the bikers. They were there to escort them because it was a lot of bikers, right? We're talking about hundreds of bikers going up Elmwood Avenue. And when they were, and the police were there to like basically escort them for safety. They said we didn't have a policy of like pulling them over and arresting them or anything else. Nobody had their lights on per se, right? So no one was theoretically being pulled over. They weren't escaping or anything else. If you had the lights on and they're behind you and saying pull over, that'd be one thing. They weren't doing that. So, but now we're hearing that, well, they did in fact give chase. And had I been at the press conference Friday morning, because I haven't had a chance to review the video yet, I would know more about what he thinks of the actions of Kyle Andres were. But as far as I know from what little I saw, Kyle Andres is in trouble for violating policies on chase and other things. So that's where we're at right now. But the policy is they're not supposed to give chase.
So now they're not supposed to give chase. That's the policy. So So if you or I are driving down the road at a high speed and decide to take a sharp right turn and accidentally hit a stop sign that then impales somebody, do you think we're getting charged for
something? This is interesting. Somebody asked that exact question of Peter Neroni yesterday. He said, if this were the same thing, an average person, and Neroni said, under the exact facts of this case, no.
I don't believe that for a minute.
It's hard to say, right? Because I was like, he said, and then he brought up a lot of case law that seems to indicate that criminal recklessness would be different. Here's the thing. You're saying a high rate of speed. At the time that he was in pursuit of the motorcyclist or the bicyclist, the car was going from 35 to 18 miles an hour. It was heavily braking as it was going. And Neroni said, this is signs that he was not being reckless, that he was braking, that he was trying hard to control the vehicle and not doing the things that rise to recklessness. Again, I think this is a judgment call that other people will disagree with. And in fact, I know the family does, and I think the family's lawyer does. So I think we're going to see other legal opinions come in. All this evidence is out there, right? You can look at everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You have all the statements from all the officers, which I've only just started to get into, but look pretty interesting and not always in comportment with the truth as expressed in the final report. Which is interesting, right? And then witness statements are there, plus more forensic evidence than I had time to even begin to look at. You know, like whole files full of pictures of measurements of the wall impact and stuff like this. So it's really kind of complete stuff.
And the second thing is, so assuming the Gonzalez family files a civil lawsuit, yeah, which they should.
It's definitely going to happen.
I would certainly do the same thing. And they win. Let's say they win, okay? Who's paying for that?
Well, that will be the taxpayers from the city of Providence.
Correct. So when police misconduct happens and an officer is sued for misconduct by the victim, the officer doesn't pay. The officer does not pay. The taxpayers of that city pay. And that's another problem with policing is that they're taking money from you. When they misbehave, when they do something they're not supposed to do, they should be held civilly liable for that. You know, if you and I, you know, hit somebody or physically assault somebody or do something that is unlawful, to be frank with you, and we are charged there, or not necessarily charged, but there's evidence there that this happened, okay? Mm-hmm. And you can win in a court that this happened. You or I get sued, guess what? We pay. You know, we don't have an organization or a town or a city that pays for us. We pay. And that, of course, helps curb that sort of behavior. You know, if you know you're going to be have to pay when you property damage or when you physically assault somebody or what have you, if you know there's going to be consequences for it, you're probably not going to do it. When you're a police officer and you know that, okay, if I assault this guy, if I kick this guy in the head, all right, first of all, if there's no video of me doing that, I'm going to get off. All right, I'm going to get off. Okay, yes. There's just that's the way it is. Okay, so you have to have video. And then even if you have video, okay, it's got to be like overwhelming, over the top, ridiculous, insane amount of motive has to be shown on the video that you wanted to, you committed this action. Okay. And then even after all that, you still don't have to pay if you're a police officer.
This is what qualified immunity is, right?
Qualified immunity.
Right.
Go on, Steve.
And so there are some places that have gotten rid of qualified immunity and replaced it with every officer carries his own personal insurance. Right.
Now, practice insurance, just like a doctor would have if they mess up, you know, a doctor does something wrong. It's not a crime. They didn't do it on purpose necessarily, but you have insurance to cover that sort of thing. The hospital doesn't pay for him. Right. The doctor pays.
And it's another interesting aspect of this is now the Providence Police budget is about $88 million, maybe $90 million in that range. These lawsuits are not counted in that budget. So let's say the Jamal's family wins and their settlement is $10 million. Well, the police have just cost us $100 million, not $90 million, right? And the thing is, the police department and the law department at the Providence City Hall is constantly dealing with all sorts of even more minor lawsuits. A police officer's car loses control for some reason and runs over your shrubs. So you just file an insurance claim. The insurance company goes to the city and says, hey, you got to pay us for these shrubs we just replaced. And that happens, right? And so that's money we put out. I heard an interesting idea floated, and I don't remember where I got this. So if it's your idea, that's my bad. But the idea would be to take this money out of the police budget. The police get sued for $10 million. Well, guess what? You have a $78 million operating budget now. You don't have an $88 million operating budget anymore.
That was not my idea, but I do like it.
Yeah,
I do
right?
like
it's
the
a,
idea.
It's a cool idea. It's a cool idea because it means, hey, police, be way more careful because every penny you waste is penny out of your final budget. It's like one less police car that you're buying this year or one less... a few less bullets you have to put in your gun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that would have much of an effect on conduct because, again, you know, it's the whole department
right.
that suffers and not the officer. I think that people really respond well to personal accountability. And I think that eliminating qualified immunity is the way to go to do that.
I think that's an interesting idea because let's take Kyle Andres, and I don't want to pick on him, but let's take him for a second. He has now done something that was really, really dangerous. If he were paying personal insurance, his insurance rates would go up, just like a bad doctor. Eventually, maybe not right away, but eventually a bad doctor with enough malpractice suits won't be able to pay for the insurance to keep himself practicing medicine.
Oh yeah, you'll be dropped from your insurance.
Right, and now you can't practice medicine anymore, right? Yeah. And so police officers could be in the same position. You beat up too many people, you do too many of these, you know, terrible things. Eventually, you just can't be a police officer anymore.
And what drives me insane is that the quote-unquote good police officers, now I'm from the theory of, are there any real good police officers? Because you see, there's obviously bad ones, right? The ones that commit crimes, the ones that do things they shouldn't be doing and stuff like that. But then you've got the other police officers that work with them and don't say anything, that right. see it happen. They all see it happen. Trust me, they all see it happen. Whether it be your mothers, your fathers, your brothers, they see it happen, okay? And they don't say anything.
This is something that happened in Providence recently too. It's the Sergeant Hanley case. Sergeant Hanley has a suspect, arrested man, I didn't say suspect, but a man he arrested on the ground, handcuffs behind his back, and he's kneeling on him, kicking him, assaulting him while he's on the ground. That video was released by Jose Bautista, formerly of Para, now a state representative, and Bautista was fired immediately for doing that. Sergeant Hanley is still on desk duty or something, awaiting charges, right? Awaiting some kind of criminal prosecution.
He's being paid, right?
I don't know if he's being paid. I believe he's being paid, yes. But I don't know if he's actually working even on desk duty. I think he might just be on suspension, but he's getting paid, right?
Yeah.
So there were a bunch of other officers there until the video came out, until he was actually embarrassed, and months went by, and this was never investigated. And then all of a sudden there's a video. And now all of a sudden, oh, well, we have to talk to all the officers. But none of those officers said, hey, Sergeant Hanley went off and kicked and beat this guy.
And you see that all the time in these videos.
Right.
You see these constantly, whether it's Eric Garner or whether it's anybody else. The officers that are with the officer that's doing the thing, the action that is frowned upon, these officers don't say anything. They never stop the person and say, what are you doing? You can't do that. What are you doing? Even though they know this body camera's on, even though they know they're on camera, the mentality is so strong that we can get away with whatever we want that they just don't seem to care.
I understand it's really hard to see somebody do something and then go to your officer and say, hey, I don't want to rat out my fellow police officer now, because that's not going to make you any friends as a police
officer. It's not. But on the other hand, don't you agree that if the good, quote unquote, good officers started speaking up, you wouldn't have this issue where everyone thinks that cops are bad people?
I agree. I mean, like, for instance, if you see somebody do something terrible like that and you don't say anything, you are absolutely complicit in that crime.
Exactly. Right?
Absolutely complicit. If I saw you kicking somebody and I didn't say, Greg, cut that out, and immediately try to render assistance to the person you were kicking, I'd be kind of helping you assault that person.
Right. And Steve, this is what we see on video. You know, granted, there are probably thousands and thousands of cases where it's not captured on video, and the suspect can't say anything because there's no evidence. Or they could say something, but who cares? Because juries tend to believe police for whatever reason, and that's just the way it is.
And also, remember, if you sustain any injuries, one of your charges is resisting arrest all the time. You're arrested. When this person was arrested, he was charged with resisting arrest, and I think assaulting a police officer, and one of the charges like this is so automatic three for you get, right? Resisting.
Disorderly,
resisting, and assaulting, right?
Yes, yes.
And they just bring this up. And so if you've got a bruise on your ribs, like, well, judge, he was resisting arrest. I had to, like, wrestle him. I had to, like, roll him on the ground. Maybe, you know, I don't know how he got those bruises, but, you know, it was the natural course of taking him into arrest. This guy went down peacefully and then got kicked. This guy went down peacefully and then had a knee put on the back of his neck just to remind him that, hey, this is how police kill black people.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. And you see this constantly. And again, it comes to the fact that the news media, I don't want to say is complicit, but they don't ask the right questions. I remember a case of, do you remember, of course, everyone remembers this, the officer who was shot in the courtroom by the suspect in Providence, PPD. This is a big story a number of years ago. I forgot the officer's name, but he was basically shot and killed at the courtroom. The guy grabbed his gun, shot him, whatever like that. And they showed, Channel 10, I remember, did, you know, a story on it, and they showed the suspect's booking photo. And he was unrecognizable. Like, he had jumped into the UFC octagon and fought everybody whole organization. Now, nobody bothered to ask, how on earth did he get like that? Okay? How did he go from shooting a cop to looking like 20 different people beat on him? I think we know the answer to that question. But the fact that none of the news organizations at the time asked, why does he look like that? Okay, because I can't imagine an instance where you'd take that person into custody right then and there, and all of a sudden their face is busted into a million pieces.
It's hard, right? Because we tend to turn a blind eye towards the excesses of our justice system when it serves our purposes.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
So if we say, well, this child molester just got beat to crap by the cops, and like, well, I'm not, or this really hideous killer is going to get the death penalty or died of COVID inside, right? They're hideous, you know, people who committed terrible crimes. Some of them died of COVID in prison. And it's hard for the average person to say that was wrong, that my heart goes out to that person, that could have been prevented and this is on us. Doesn't really occur to us. We just think, well, that's what they get. You know, I see people talking about Jamal Gonzalez and saying, he didn't have a license plate on his moped. He was driving the way he was driving with all those others. He kind of deserves what he gets.
Can you imagine that, though?
But I'm like, wait a minute. What are you talking about? You're saying that this 24-year-old kid deserves to be in a coma or deserves to die because he was goofing around on a motorcycle in the street with 100 other people and the police escorting them? You know what I mean? There's certain
things. Mob mentality, the punishments that the mob mentality wants to dish out to people is comically bad. I mean, you know, you see it all the time. If you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, you see this constantly where someone committed a crime, usually a minority, and the people make up excuses for why the police mistreated them. Right. And it's ridiculous. The penalty for driving an ATV illegally is not you get put in a coma for 6 months.
No, or forever.
Or forever. That's right. I mean, who
here's
knows?
The thing. It's not the penalty is way less. It's not. I don't even think there's like prison time attached. Unless you've
right, it's probably just a fine or something, or confiscation of the bike. Who knows?
They probably give you a ticket. They take your bike.
Right.
and you walk home and you're out $400-$500 or whatever it costs you to get the right. ATV or the moped or whatever it is. Maybe it's $1,000. I don't know what they cost, but you know, right. whatever
and
it
you,
is, you're out that
and you
money.
See this, you see this constantly, Steve, where, you know, someone does something innocuous, you know, whether it's yelling at a cop or, you know, not listening to a basic instruction. And the instruction is not show me, you know, that you don't have a gun. It's something dumb like that. And the police react way over the top to it.
Yes.
You know, it's not a good system of law enforcement.
Over the summer, during the protests, the Black Lives Matter style protests that were happening here in Rhode Island, there was a particular state trooper who just immediately would go to his car, pull out canisters of mace, pepper spray, and just start indiscriminately spraying anyone in the crowd. You know, Will James, reporter for Uprise, done amazing work this summer. He got hit with some pepper spray.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sorry, but there is absolutely no way Will presents anything like a threat. The woman next to him was splash soaked with pepper spray, right? And again, she was holding a iPhone videotaping the event. She wasn't doing anything at all. She just got soaked with this stuff. And again, this indiscriminate use of pepper spray, this indiscriminate use of violence against people. Here's the thing. Police want to preserve order. They don't want people rampaging through the streets, whatever. Their job is, however that works, fine. You know, we can talk about those things later. But again, the penalty for standing on the side of the road and recording police is there is no penalty for that.
Right. So if you get hit by not a crime.
Right. Not only is it not a crime, it's a constitutionally protected right. And so you don't. So there is no way that is acceptable behavior on the part of the police. In fact, it's assault. And if I walk down the street and assault and start spraying people with pepper spray, whether they're acting up or not, I would be arrested.
You can't even use pepper spray in war. It is banned by the Geneva Convention.
And so we should really start thinking about what we're using against their own people.
Right. I mean, the weapons that cops are allowed to get away with is mind-boggling to me. Pepper spray causes real damage to your eyes. Okay. Some people go weeks and weeks and weeks with irritation, with partial blindness, stuff like that. And the fact is, if it's banned in war, it should be banned against civilians, period.
It's really, really atrocious. And it is scary. But then you hear about accounts of other cities where activists are out every night and they get used to it. They say, yeah, after a while, I just like understand pepper spray. You just live with it.
Imagine that.
Yeah, and they say after the first couple times or even tear gas, after the first couple times of getting hit with tear gas, you don't worry about it anymore. You're just like, okay, this is tear gas. I know what to expect. I get through it. My eyes water. I do the stuff. And then I can still stay out there. It's not really even dispersing crowds anymore because we have people out there who are used to being tear gassed now.
Yep. So if tear gas isn't enough, then you've got tasers, okay, which is when the police basically shoot you with 60,000 volts at a low amperage and put you out. Mm-hmm. There's been numerous instances documented where tasers caused real medical events to people. Yep. And yet somehow, some way, they're still allowed in use. And I don't quite understand
rubber bullets,
how that is. And I was going to touch on rubber bullets as well. Rubber bullets, just like real bullets, only just less lethal, as they call it, less lethal projections until you get one in your eye or anywhere else on your body.
There are some pictures out there of people who have been hit in the eye.
Right.
Rubber bullets.
And cops will use rubber bullets indiscriminately because they feel they're, quote unquote, less lethal. They're not going to kill anybody, so let's just spray people.
Channel 12 has an issue of a guy, interview with a person who was driving to work during one night and got shot by a police officer in the face with a rubber bullet.
And there's no ramifications for that.
They're suing. They're doing some stuff. They haven't really come forward. They don't want to really be known publicly, which I understand. They want have private citizens, but they were, I mean, basically he was just riding through saying, hey, what's going on? Window down and boom, hit right in the face while he's driving. No reason. Yep. Wasn't doing anything. He was a person of color who looked at a cop the wrong way, maybe for half a second. And the cop says, like that.
Yep. And it all comes down to this. And this, you know, might be a controversial take, but it's what I see. It all comes down to laziness. Okay. You know, police, you know, before tasers and before everything else would use their bare hands to seduce suspects. Not seduce. It was the wrong word there. I guess they would use their bare hands to do that if that was what they were doing. But to subdue, that's the word I'm looking for. Subdue a suspect. Use your bare hands. Your billy club back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I mean, you use your own, you know, brawn to take a suspect down. And it seemed a little more fair that way. And fact is, you know, if police are going to wear that valor like they do, you know, the whole you're heroes and, you know, want people to look up to you, then act like it. Act like it. Nobody's a hero that shoots pepper spray at people. You're not a hero for shooting rubber bullets. That's not what heroes do. Heroes don't shoot first and ask questions later. Heroes put their lives on the line. Like, you say it, but do you do it?
It's a hard thing, right? And it gets back to the idea of whether we need police and whether we need this form of policing, whether or not communities have a right to their own policing, to determine their own policing, or is this something that we impose on them from the government? I mean, theoretically, we, the citizens of this country, have control over the way the police enforce, even what the laws are. We decide what those laws are. We have, like, some things we all agree on. Don't kill each other. Don't, you know, steal each other's stuff, that kind of thing, right? We agree on these issues. And then we say, how do we enforce these codes? And I think one way we enforce these codes is maybe not put people into a position where they're so poor they feel that theft is their only option.
Exactly. You know, income inequality has a lot to do with this, Steve. You're exactly right. You know, a lot of these, you're seeing a lot of break-ins lately. You're seeing a lot of, car thefts, things like people looking for cash because they don't have cash. You know, it's right. They're not stealing the stuff necessarily to buy, you know, a laptop or an iPhone. These people now with COVID need cash to buy food. I mean, it's a bad situation where people need money to survive, to pay rent.
We don't have mental health services. We don't have drug services, like things that can help people deal with, you know, their addiction, their various addictions and that kind of stuff, right? We understand theoretically in our heads that addiction is a disease, not a crime. Yet we treat it as a crime. We don't send in a doctor to deal with a person who's having a crisis. We send in police. And again, I think we're going to make this point later, but right, like very few times do the police get called because of violence.
Yeah. I mean, we can bring that up now, actually. Okay. You know, one of the things I looked at for this episode was how often police are called how many times police have calls, okay, where there's violence involved, where you know, someone with a gun is actually necessary or might be necessary to squash a situation. And I looked at one report from, this was the New Haven Independent over in Connecticut, and I also looked at four or five other independent reports around the nation that had done similar studies, and they all came to almost the exact same conclusion. And that conclusion is that 96% of police calls nationwide, on average, do not involve violence, do not involve needing an officer with a gun ready to shoot somebody or ready to, you know, throw down. 96%. You know, the number one call police get is responding to alarms, and most of the time they're false alarms. You've got 911 callbacks, you know, someone calls 911 and hangs up, you know, domestic arguments, things like that, you know, that don't really boil over to, you know, requiring, you know, violent intervention, things of that nature. It's very, very few times police are actually needed for the thing that you think of police as being needed for, which is showing up, you know, guns drawn, you know, put your hands up, you know, and defending a situation. That's rarely happening. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at that, you start to wonder, Steve, you know, there are situations for sure when you need police, and we'll get to one in a second, but there are a lot of situations where, whether it's especially mental health situations, where the police are the last people you should be called in. And the way we treat mentally ill people in this country is just a tragedy because, you know, I'll tell you, it's not jails these days, prisons, I should say, are filled with mentally ill people. You know, yes. I'm of the belief now, you know, and this could be controversial. I don't know how other people really think about this, but I believe that people in prison, obviously at one point or another, or even now, had a mental health episode. Okay. Because Steve and I, all right, we don't wake up in the morning and, you know, and say, all right, that person really pissed me off. I think I want to kill him, or I think I might stab them, or I think I might want to rape this girl or this child, or it just, the thought never enters your mind at all. It's not an option. Okay. Whereas these people that have actually done this stuff, okay, not only was it an option, it was the option that they did. They went and did it. Now, something clearly is not right in your head if you're committing these types of crimes, okay? So the fact is that I believe there's a mental health issue with anyone that commits a serious crime like that. But some are more obvious than others. When you see, you know, whether you watch a prison show that goes into these real prisons or what, you see that these people are, some of them are very, very seriously disturbed, okay? Whether it's hearing voices or whatnot. These people should not be in prison. They need to get help. They need mental health assistance, like right now.
And I think the experience of prison is itself a mental health crisis for many people.
For sure.
Right.
For sure.
So you can take a person who, you know, went for a joyride in a car and served 6 months, and that person just spent 6 months in prison. And I think that experience has mental health, like,
ramifications.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Definitely. And I don't know that prisons solve our problems. Obviously, we don't want people like Jeffrey Dahmer free to roam the streets. On the other hand, even Jeffrey Dahmer is obviously mentally ill and needs some help, right? We want restitution. If somebody embezzles a bunch of money from a company, we want that person in jail isn't making the money back, isn't doing anything to pay restitution, right?
Yep.
We need to think about how we make things right, because that's kind of what justice is about. We don't need to think about how we punish a person, right? We want people to learn from their mistakes. We want people to not perform certain actions. How do we get there? We have to rethink that, because the system we have now is not working, is inherently racist, right?
There's no doubt about that.
The breakdown of the people who are incarcerated is nothing like the breakdown of the people of Rhode Island.
Right. And anyone that believes that, black people just commit more crimes, and that's why there are more of them in prison. I think that we've seen the last 4 years especially that's not the case at all. In fact, it is police treating people completely differently based on the color of their skin.
Our entire criminal justice system, from the police down to the judges.
We've seen, and we want to talk to Senator Mack about this later, but you see Black Lives Matter protests. Everyone's seen them. And you've seen police reactions to those protests. Now, last Wednesday, something much more serious happened. And it appears from reports, Washington Post is reporting, in fact, that based on instructions from the Pentagon, from the Department of Defense, they were intentionally allowed right-wing rioters to breach the nation's capital. The Pentagon went so far as to deny Maryland Governor Larry Hogan had requested to send the National Guard in a timely manner, you know, well before this kind of really got out of control. And the Pentagon denied that request multiple times, but in the Trump administration, multiple times before they finally relented and said, okay, well after it would have been helpful to have the National Guard in. So we have a situation here where there was, in fact, a time where the police could prove useful, okay? We needed that brawn. There were people breaching the Capitol building, rioting and ransacking and everything else, and the police did the opposite of what you'd expect. You go online and look. There's video of them aiding the rioters, opening the gates for them, okay? Taking selfies with them inside the Capitol, okay? They're inside the Capitol. They're already trespassing, and these folks are taking selfies with them. And even the rioters were quoted as thinking like, yeah, the police were with us. This it was strange. It was weird. They were like on our side. That to me is like, okay, well, you know, if you're a defender of the police, right, you can say that, you know, police are needed for every instance and what have you. But when they truly are, when the left agrees that the police might have been helpful in this situation, where were they? They were nowhere. So it begs the question, what do we have the police for if when we do actually need them, they not only abandoned us, but in fact invited an enemy into the government? They literally, we spend $800 or so billion a year defending this country when all it took was 250 or so dedicated people committed to breaching that building and coordinating with police who seemed to be on their side. And that's it. They got in. They sat in Nancy Pelosi's desk. They went on the dais and stood there and conducted like a fake, you know, a session of Congress just to be funny. And that's what happened. And as far as, you know, the police defenders go, I don't know how you defend what happened last week at the Capitol, because it was just an abdication of duty in every sense of the word.
I think it's interesting when you're on Twitter and other places, Facebook and the other social media platforms, to see the response to generally peaceful Black Lives Matter protests that happened in the Capitol. And you will see swarms of fully outfitted, militarized police and National Guard, helmeted, armed to the teeth, basically just standing in a line, too deep sometimes,
yep,
to make sure that everybody knows you cannot pass this point, right?
Yep.
I think about President Trump deciding to do his Bible photo shoot, right? Basically sending out troops to clear a path through protesters, peaceful protests, peaceful, absolutely 100%. It was like religious protesters out
there. For sure.
Pushing them out of the way basically brutalizing them so that he could stand there with the Bible and pose, right? And you think, okay, now we have this other group of, you know, Trump supporters, and they were treated very differently. I've been to a lot of protests, and I've seen a lot of arrests. I have never seen such a hands-off thing taken, right? At our own state house, right? I've seen it more militarized than the Capitol building was, and scarily so for entirely peaceful protests. Yeah. And they'll justify that by saying, well, there was a small amount of vandalism. A window got broken, some spray paint on the state house. And I'm like, all right, fine. But that could probably just as easily have been stopped by a couple of police officers standing there. I'm sorry, it doesn't need a full, you don't need three Humvees parked in the state house parking lot.
No, they don't.
And dozens and dozens of state police officers hiding behind a corner ready to leap out and jump into action.
Right, and the response to a small amount of property damage is not an overwhelming response with tear gas and just an indiscriminate, you know, attacking and going after everybody. That's not the right response either. Steve, one of the things I wanted to cover here that I think our listeners would be eager to learn more about is the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights,
yeah.
LEBOR, as it's known by its acronym. You know, there's it's basically a law, okay? Some states have this law, not every state. 37 states or so. And it basically was created in the 70s, I believe. It became kind of popular. But the Rhode Island one, I'm not sure when that was passed exactly, but I know that the LEBOR laws started becoming popular in the 70s, and they've been strengthened, I believe, over time. But what they do is they basically set a different set of standards for police when they do something wrong, when they do something perhaps criminally that you know, may not be considered criminally because they're police, but basically, you know, when they do something bad, all right, they've got a different set of standards than you and I have. Okay, when you and I get in trouble, you know, we don't have these protections, and police have a set of protections enshrined in law that covers, let's put it bluntly, covers their ass when they screw up. And much of these stipulations claim to only come into play when the officer is under investigation for a non-criminal matter. But for all intents and purposes, that's all investigations. As we've alluded to earlier, it's so rare for a police officer to be criminally charged. They try to move everything to it's just a civil thing, like the Gonsalves incident, right, for example. You know, this police officer was clearly violating department conduct. He got somebody in severe injury. And there's no criminal ramification for it, whereas you and I obviously would be in a different situation. And so this officer used LEBOR, okay, to protect themselves in certain situations.
LEBOR is an automatic process in a sense, because it like they talk about invoking LEBOR, and like a police officer is going to get in trouble and he invokes LEBOR. It's always there in the back of a police chief's mind when he's bringing punishments to his officers,
right,
that they could invoke LEBOR. And there's like right now, if you say you're suspended for 2 days, the officer has to take that suspension and cannot invoke LEBOR. However, if you say 3 days, the officer can say, I'm going to fight this. And now we're going to go through this 8-month, 4-month, whatever process, long process. And so the invoking of LEBOR, but LEBOR is always there, right? So it's not so much that they invoke it. It's just that it's always, so you're a police chief and you think, this guy deserves at least a week's suspension. But if I give him a week, he's going to invoke LEBOR. It's going to take forever. So I'll, yes, just give him the 2 days because that's the best I can do.
Yeah, yeah. No, it happens all the time. If you, right, happen to see, you know, an officer suspended for 2 days, now you know why it's 2 days and not, yeah, 3 days or a week or a month or, right, 6 months or whatever. That's one of the reasons here. And when I say invoke LEBOR, there are a lot of clauses in the LEBOR law that happen automatically. But there are also some where the police officer has to say, you know, I'm doing this, or I'm revoking my rights under LEBOR, et cetera, and so on. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, these investigations that LEBOR, you know, covers affect almost everything that a cop would do that you or I would find illegal. You know, as Attorney General Nerona has shown time and time again, cops just cannot seem to be charged criminally in Rhode Island. It's just not a thing that happens. So let's just say, for all intents and purposes, these rules apply to the overwhelming majority of investigations of police officers here in Rhode Island.
They apply to all the officers in Rhode Island because LEBOR is a state law, and it applies to every police officer, state and municipal down.
Gotcha. Yep. So first of all, this is big, guys. Listen to this. So there's no bail, okay? In fact, you know, a police officer who commits, you know, something that you or I would consider a crime, have the opposite of bail. And instead of locking them up until, you know, like bail, they get locked up until you pay a sum of money or get a bail bondsman. It's usually, you know, 10% of your bail amount, something like that. The police, they're left free and they're paid on top of it. So let me make this clear. If you've messed up as a police officer, you're given paid vacation as punishment up front, okay? No jail, no bail, vacation. For up to 6 months, LIBOR covers you, okay? On your dime, by the way. This is your dime. You as a taxpayer are paying for these bad police officers to be on vacation, to be on paid leave while they investigate what happened. You're paying for that. So let's talk about, you know, the conduct of the interrogation. So when the cop is first, you know, made known that, okay, you messed up here, we're going to, you know, investigate you and we want to talk. It's much different than when it's conducted when you're interrogating a civilian. There's really not many rules, you know. It's just do whatever you want kind of deal, especially when, you know, there's no video recording surveillance going on. You know, I found this funny. You know, the officer really needs to be coddled and treated with kid gloves when the interrogation is taking place. They can't be threatened with any sort of discipline, okay? No public statements are allowed at all about the investigation, you know, until it's concluded. And even then, there's limits on what can be said. Why don't we get that treatment? You know, if you or I commit a crime, our name, our mugshot, it's everywhere. It's all over the place. You know, we did something wrong. We messed up at our job. You know, we're everywhere. You know, they plaster it. So-and-so did this, you know, whatever. You know, just look at the person that wasted all of those Moderna vaccines, you know, maliciously. I forget what state it was in, but they did that pharmacy. Maliciously. Yeah. And, you know everything about this person. You know their political beliefs. You know this, everything about that guy. You know, if that was a police officer, you wouldn't even know their name.
I'll tell you this about the conduct of the interrogations. When you're interviewed, there'll be a union rep and your lawyer in the room, if you so choose. And theoretically, police officers don't have that Fifth Amendment protection from incriminating themselves. And so anything you say when they're doing this conduct might not be able to be used in a trial. So that's one of the reasons they seal it, is because we might have to reinterrogate you, and then you can like access your Fifth Amendment rights maybe then. But sometimes they'll do an interview. Guy could admit everything. And it'll never see light of day.
I mean, it's just an interesting dynamic in how the police are treated in these situations versus how civilians are treated. You know, in America, we always like to say you're innocent until proven guilty, right? But that seems to really only apply to police, because if I commit a crime, right, I'm put in jail and I have to pay bail. Wouldn't that seem like implied guilt to me? I've got to pay a fee to get out of a cage. That seems like that you're saying I did the crime, that I'm guilty, okay, until I pay a fee and then, you know, go to court and prove I'm innocent. Whereas the police, they actually get the innocent until proven guilty clause. So that's something to think about. Right to a hearing. So right off the bat here, statute of limitations is 3 years, okay? So no matter what you do, okay, they're saying, you know, it doesn't count for real felonies like murder and stuff like that. But as we've seen, if you're not considering what the police officer did, murder, then guess what? It's not a crime you're going after them for. So the statute of limitations is 3 years, whereas with you and I or whatever, it's the law. You know, however many years it is, 7 years, 10 years, 20 years, I think it's unlimited for murder, homicide, things like that. You know, the hearing itself, this is the best, and I say best, I mean the worst, part of LIBOR. The hearing, okay, the hearing is a farce, all right? It consists of three people. Now, all three people can be cops, all right? The first two are definitely going to be cops. I believe active or retired cops. One has to be active. One can be active or retired. Then the third person is essentially, I believe they have to be an active officer. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that they have to be an active police officer.
Yeah, it's there's a neutral arbiter chosen somehow, and then there's somebody chosen by the police chief, and then there's someone chosen by the officer himself.
Right.
The neutral arbiter generally ping-pongs back and forth between the guy who tends to be with the police officer, who tends to be with...
Well, from what I read, the neutral arbiter comes from a list that I believe the chief and the police unions associations, they kind of submit that, and it kind of comes off of that.
And that's why it ping-pongs back and forth, right? Because the union's going to put in people who are very much in favor of the officer, and the chief is going to put people who are very much in favor of the chief. So every other hearing is slightly tilted towards either the chief or the officer, because the other two people are chosen by the chief and the officer. So theoretically, a three-man thing, let's say they all had like only going to go to bat for their ideology, not for the facts, it's always going to go 1-1, and then the middle one is going to go with the union or the chief, depending. Now, in actuality, some of these hearings come down to be 3-0 a lot, in either for or against, because all three say, yeah, this guy deserves this punishment. Because mostly Leober deals with smaller punishments. It's not so much that you're getting fired. It's like, I'm getting a 6-month suspension, so I might as well fight it. So it's an interesting, yep. So that right there is a problem, right? Because it's all police officers.
Right.
And two lawyers, by the way. Right. There's going to be a lawyer on both sides as well.
Right. And as much as, you know, the public might think, oh, well, one of the people is against the police officer that did this because they're on the chief's side. You know, that's not necessarily true.
Right.
Cops, it's a brotherhood. They say that, you know, it's a brotherhood. The unions are literally called that, you know, International Brotherhood of Police Organization. Right. You know, they say that. So the fact is, it's definitely not an automatic thing. And in fact, you know, it might even be the opposite, where, you know, you're expecting these cops or active retired cops or whatever to just automatically say, well, the evidence is there, we're going to, you know, choose to convict. And that's not the case. As you see in Leibor hearings, it's just not the case. You know, the police are getting off a very large amount of times.
Yeah. And there's stuff out there to reform Leibor, which we'll get to. So we'll get to that.
One thing I wanted to point out with this whole thing I'm covering here, I'm trying to point out the differences between how the police are treated versus how you and I would be treated in the same situation. Okay. So now think about it. You know, you're an activist, right? You chain yourself to a building. You're part of a protest. Okay, good for you. Great. And you're arrested, and that's fine. You expect to be arrested. That's that sort of thing. But you get brought into court for your trial, and there's a 3-judge panel. And the judges are two current activists, okay, that you've seen around, you might have even been at a protest with, and a former activist. How cool would that be? I mean, your hopes are pretty high at that point. When you see that, you walk into that, you're thinking, wow, this is great. This is going to be really fantastic. Now, granted, if you really did something heinous, anyone with integrity is probably going to say, all right, this is too much. You know, we've got to convict here. But if the evidence is close, or if it's just, you know, not good enough for your liking, or you know, oh, they probably did it, but you know, whatever, you're gonna side with your kind. You know, you're just gonna do that. These people are like me. They quote unquote put their lives on the line all these years, and I'm an officer. They're an officer. You know, I can see where they're coming from, and so I'm gonna let them off. And that's why there's a huge danger with the way that works. Okay, you don't need to be a police officer to know if someone's actions were warranted or not, right. Okay? You know, the thing with police is a lot of times is they say, you don't know what it's like. You don't know how to do my job or stand in my shoes and then you can judge me. That's not how it works in life, okay? I'm a website designer, okay, by trade, and you do not need to be a website designer to tell me if a design I made sucks.
It's true.
Okay, you do not have to be an expert. I don't have to be a professional painter to walk into a room and say, this looks terrible, okay? I don't have to be a home builder to point out flaws in my home, you know, whether it's a wall that's cracking from settling or a foundation that's cracked or whatever issues there are with the house. I don't need to know how to build houses to know that there's a problem, okay?
Sort of like just, Steven Spielberg isn't a movie critic.
Just like, exactly.
Yeah.
Just like the judges who hear every other case on earth, okay, don't have to be police officers or don't have to be whatever profession the accused is to know if the accused is worthy of being found innocent or guilty. So the fact is that line about needing that is completely untrue. So anyway, now you know how cops feel about being investigated. It's to me, it's a joke. But let's continue. So here's one of the craziest parts. If you're somehow, through some magic, you know, blip in the space-time continuum, charged and convicted of a felony as a police officer, and you're a cop, you get to keep all of your benefits, dental, medical, disability, life insurance. You get to keep it all until all of your appeals are heard. So if you're, you know, convicted for murder or whatever, okay, and yeah, you're you know, put in prison or what have you, and you're appealing, obviously, you know, your benefits continue, Okay, you don't get paid, thankfully, but your benefits continue. Now, okay, now you can argue whether that's fair or not. You know, the person's family didn't do anything wrong, so if they're receiving those benefits, good for them. You know, that's fine. Okay, great. But that doesn't happen with you or I. Okay, if Steve Ahlquist was charged with a crime, okay, now granted, he's a well-known person, but he was charged with a crime, right, that he didn't do, okay, his life is over for a period of time, okay, it's pretty much over. People are going to assume he did whatever he's accused of, because that's just how people are.
I didn't do it.
And and he's pretty much convicted in the eye of the public. That's just how it is. You hear it on the news, you know, someone is accused of this, you just assume, well, they probably did it, you know, and... So that's the big difference there, is that, you know, when you or I do something, we don't have to be convicted for our lives to be turned upside down. Where you're a cop and you're convicted, you get to keep your benefits until all of your appeals are heard. And that could take years. So that's Libor in a nutshell. You know, the big takeaway from all this is that cops are almost never charged for the crimes they commit. It's just the way it is, ever. Attorney generals like Peter Noronha are petrified of police unions. They're petrified. And when they do get charged, Libor is going to cover their ass, because the adjudicators are police officers. And that's how policing works in Rhode Island. And that needs to change.
I will say, I think Peter Noronha would say he's not petrified of police officers, just to be clear. But I think, you know, he would say that he's not. But I just want to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is my opinion, obviously. From what I observe out there, it seems that that's the case. That, you know, the AGs just don't want to be involved in that sort of thing in terms of pushing police and charging them with a crime. And it's crazy, because just because you charge an officer with a crime doesn't mean they're going to be convicted. Yeah. I mean, there's if the evidence is not there to prove them guilty, then fine. That's what the court system is for. It's for that. So it's quite interesting that there's so many layers to even prevent them from getting to that point where we have a jury and decide whether they're guilty or not.
Over the last 6 months or so, former state senator Harold Metz had a commission to reform Leober and to find, you know, things we could do to change it. And the commission was made up of, I forget how many people, maybe 15 people. On your final votes as to what changes they wanted to bring to Leober, one of the suggestions was to repeal it outright, because as we know, Leober isn't in every state. Some states deal with this through the court system. There was a vote, and the vote came down to something like 7-5 against repealing Leober outright. But had this the makeup of this commission been slightly different, we would have had a opinion that says repeal Leober. And I think that's something to keep in mind, that it's very close.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Senator Metz, because leading that change is our special guest today. Newly inaugurated Senator Tiara Mack defeated Harold Metz in the last election in November.
That's
and
right.
Actually, not in the primary, I should say.
Primary.
Which took place in, what was that, August? September, I think, somewhere around there. Yeah. And she defeated him handily. And Senator Mack, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on this very important topic.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Tiara. This is Steve.
It's Steve. Steve has instructed me that I should always try to refer to elected officials by their title. You know, for example, Senator Mack. And then once he taught me that, Steve went on and immediately called you Tiara. So I give up. I don't know what to do.
Sorry.
I mean, either one works for me. It's still weird to have the senator in front. I still feel like Tiara. But yeah,
it's a lifelong title now. Even if you were to be voted out next time, you'd still be able to call yourself Senator Mack. So it's kind of cool.
So Senator Mack, again, thanks for joining us. I want to start locally. You know, this summer we caught glimpses of BLM protests everywhere from Portland to Providence. And it appeared from my point of view that police had very little tolerance for even the smallest provocations, often using weapons banned by the Geneva Convention against unarmed, peaceful protesters who were often not involved in any violence. On the other hand, we witnessed just last week and many other instances, predominantly white pro-Trump groups committing far worse offenses to the police or to property, and not only remain untouched by police, but have the red carpet rolled out for them, which is really the only way I can describe what occurred at the Capitol last Wednesday.
Yeah.
Why do you think this sort of double standard is allowed to perpetuate, and can anything be done about it legislatively?
Well, unfortunately, this double standard has always existed. I grew up in the South, and I also was a high school teacher in New Bedford, Mass, and have worked in Rhode Island schools as well here in Providence. And I see that double standard in the amount of Black and Brown children who get suspended from schools at a higher rate than their white counterparts for doing the same exact things. I see it in the treatment of Black and Brown individuals who, through no fault of their own, live in extreme poverty and have to work paycheck to paycheck and sometimes often commit crimes in order to make ends meet, because we have criminalized poverty and we have criminalized behaviors based on a person's skin color. So the double standard does not shock me. It does not surprise me. It saddens me. It angers me. But nothing that I saw on Wednesday really struck me as out of line with the America that I grew up with.
And I think that's the problem, you know, as people see this and they think, that's how it is. It's okay. I mean, not activists for sure. Not the people on the left, mm-hmm. but a lot of the moderates, if you want to call them that, you know, they see this and they think, wasn't me, whatever, no big deal. And that's unfortunate. And I just, it's unfortunate that we can't get around that.
One of the things I noticed about the, events in Washington was, there's a lot of calls for the police to get new training in how to de-escalate. And as somebody pointed out on Twitter, and I don't remember who said this, we see that police do know how to de-escalate because they were working with the Trump people to de-escalate the situation constantly, not to make arrests when they could avoid it, not to use violence. And they chose to do it then. And other times with BLM protests, they choose to not de-escalate. So I think the idea of extra training being required was called into question by the behavior of the police in the Capitol.
Yeah, well, I think de-escalation training, again, only works when the standards are not based on someone's race. We know that racial profiling exists in many areas in the United States judicial system, criminal system, education system, the housing system. Name a system, and there's probably some racial prejudice and racial bias present in that system. So I don't think it's just about teaching de-escalation skills, because I think it was the eight to abolition movement, and there's the eight to defunding or eight to something. And it was like banning chokeholds and banning excessive force, requiring cameras. And even though there are states that require those things, there are states that put bans on them, they still happen and they still occur to Black and Brown bodies. And that is because we have a conversation that for too long in this country has gone untouched. We saw the performative actions of cabinet members resign the day of or after the incident at the State House or at the Capitol building. And it was all a performance. No one even touched the conversation about what does it actually mean that these insurrectionists came into the Capitol building, felt empowered by forces there, by police officers, and they don't look like the Black Lives Matter protests. People were trying to draw comparisons, but this is more a comparison to the Civil War, where we saw people fighting against legislation and against the law of the land to abolish slavery. We saw this in folks protesting outside of an elementary school when Ruby Bridges was a 6-year-old going into an elementary school that was in the desegregated South. And so we need to start having conversations about what does it mean when supremacy, and by supremacy, I mean white supremacy, feels like it is leaving and losing its grip on quote unquote power. Why do these people feel so emboldened, and why do they feel so threatened by conversations about equality and equity across our nation? And that's the conversation that GOP leaders and anyone who resigned are refusing to have by their resignation.
You know, the feeling I get, Senator Mack, and I don't know if you agree, but the feeling I get is that the white people in power are worried that if the minorities, whether it be, you know, Black people or Hispanic, come to power, okay, that the white people are going to be treated the same way that white people treat Black people now.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a thing that I've heard, or like I can only theorize, but I can only use my own lived experiences. I know that power feels good for some people. The idea of having power and to be able to dictate what luxuries you are able to have, what luxuries your community are able to have, and to be able to be the haves versus the have-nots is exactly what the United States is predicated on. There have always been the people who wield power over another group. We've seen it in slavery. We've seen it in the claiming of lands by the indigenous people who were here first. We've seen it in so many different instances in the United States that power is wielded and hoarded by groups of people. And that with that power, and power is just a neutral term. I think when power is shared amongst people who have ideas that are people first, power is a force that can shepherd change and shepherd conversations and shepherd equality. But when that power is hoarded by people who aren't people first, who don't have empathy for their fellow man, who don't think about how their actions impact others, that's where we have this idea that if we lose this power, we will then be subjected to what it's like on the other side. And we're not trying to say, as the antithesis of that thought or that narrative, we're not trying to say that someone else should be able to stand in our shoes. We are saying that no one should have to stand in these shoes, and no one should have to be a victim of hoarded power.
I agree completely. That's a very good way to put it. And I think that more people, especially white people, need to understand that these folks are not, you know, black people that are oppressed by police on a regular basis. They're not looking for revenge. They're not looking for revenge. And I saw a number of black activists I follow on Twitter had said, you know, had mentioned that, you know, after the incidents of Wednesday. And they said, listen, we're not asking you to shoot these rioters, you know, like you do us. We're asking you to not shoot us, right, like you didn't shoot these rioters.
Right. And that's a powerful statement.
Yeah. And it's just that whole Wednesday incident is just, we could talk about that in an entire episode, just about what went down there. But there's certainly going to be heads rolling and certainly lessons to be learned from that. Keeping the topic with police, of course. The New Haven Independent, I talked about this earlier, New Haven Independent have released a report this year indicating that for the last 2 years, 2018 to 2020, 95.6% of cop calls did not involve violence. Other studies nationwide have concluded similar results. So it's about 90.6% on average of police calls, dispatch calls, do not involve violence. In other words, do not involve a situation where they might need to use physical harm or use a gun or something like that. And me and Steve had alluded to earlier that, you know, perhaps there's a lot of instances then where police may not be needed. They're deployed to now. And I wanted to get your takeaway from those numbers.
Yeah, well, I am a fierce advocate that policing, as we see it in this country, it needs to be abolished. There are reformers out there who think that we can work within the current system that exists. I have seen the system destroy communities and families through readings and through my own lived experience as a Black person who has had family members incarcerated. I believe that the system that currently exists is not a system predicated on justice, predicated on equality, and predicated on keeping our community safe, because the people who are over-policed are too often people living in poverty, people who are low income, people who are Black, people who are brown, people who are recently immigrated, and people who are, by the standards of this country, not quote-unquote worthy of justice. And so I think it's a hard conversation to have, but again, for too long, people have push the conversation aside because they're too afraid of what those answers might be. What is the solution when someone calls for a domestic violence situation? Is it policing, or is it social programs to help remove the people from the situation? Is it quality housing? Is it making sure that people have enough money so that there's no fighting over resources in low-income communities? Is it making sure that there are more people who are able to address and moderate tensions between neighbors and between people in cars? Is it making sure that we have quality mental health services for people who are experiencing mental health crisis, and so they're not diverted to prisons, but they're getting the help that they need from a medical professional? What are the conversations that we're actually going to start talking? Because like you said, if it's 85% of these calls are nonviolent, there has to be an answer that isn't policing and that isn't the justice or incarceration system. There has to be an answer within systems that we can build outside of the current policing system that can answer these problems.
I like that a lot. And I think about that a lot, and I do some reading on it. And I'm happy to see that some people are starting to think about what those institutions might look like and how we might establish them and what it would take to get from here to there, right? To that better world where we send health professionals, mental health professionals, instead of armed police officers to intervene in certain incidences, and how we prevent crime maybe by just providing better care for people in general, right? People don't have mental health issues, meltdowns in public as often because they're better cared for and they're able to stay on their medications.
Senator Mack, what is the best response that one can give to, or what do you think is the best response that one can give when the people that are that feel that the police protect them, okay? If we got rid of the police, like, they would get robbed tomorrow, okay? That's, we know that's not true, but that's what a lot of, you know, police apologists seem to believe. What do you say to them? Like, okay, well, all right, so 96% of cop calls are nonviolent. You know, it clearly shows less of a need for police than people believe. So, all right, we should reduce, you know, police in general, the number of police, and what calls they're responding to and whatnot. And people get nervous about that, you know, especially on the right, get nervous about that thing. What do you say to them about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer for that because it's really hard for me to look past the harm and the violence I've seen at the hands of police for people who look like me in my communities to say, I can use all of my lived experience, but in my experience, speaking with people who are firmly on the side of policing and police, they don't care about the lived experience of Black and brown people who are victims of stop and frisk, of racial profiling, who have been disciplined in their public schools by school resource officers because they were too loud or too boisterous, or they upset a teacher who didn't share their identities. And it's all those ways that we can start having a conversation. What are you really afraid of? And is it linked to your property? Why is someone stealing? Why are you afraid of someone stealing your TV? Is it because they don't have enough money? Is it because they're working paycheck to paycheck? Is it because there are unemployment rates that aren't being addressed? Is it because there's not enough job training? What are you going to do to like get uncomfortable with the uncomfortable? Are you afraid of poverty? If you're afraid of poverty, what are you going to do to address poverty in your state, in your city, at the municipal level? If you're afraid of people who don't look like you, what are you going to do to have more conversations with people who don't share your identities? Get uncomfortable with the uncomfortable. And that's the only way we can move forward and push people past their biases and to real conversations about solutions that work for every single person and community.
It's a very good point you brought up. You know, understanding the causes of this of these situations helps you when you're coming up with answers. And now that you're in the Senate, you're in a position to finally affect positive change from a legislative point of view. What are your top priorities for this year's session? And for those that support these priorities, what can our listeners do to get involved?
Yeah, well, we are still in the middle of a global pandemic, so all of my priorities are going to be tied to making sure that we are addressing the housing crisis, making sure that no one is evicted during this global pandemic, during the coldest months of the year. No one should be evicted, period, ever, especially during the coldest months of the year in a global pandemic, making sure that we are addressing healthcare. We are, again, facing an unprecedented health crisis, and we have people who lost their jobs through this pandemic and have lost their access to affordable healthcare. What are we going to do to address that? Also, we have to reckon with, there are people who lost their job and 2 weeks in, they were being faced with eviction. They were being faced with car repossessions. They were being faced with not being able to pay their bills for food and for all of the like life's basic necessities. What are we going to do to address a real living wage in our state? And so those are the top issues that I'm concerned about, including education. We saw there is still a heated argument about whether or not it's safe to return to school, if there is a safe return to school plan. So on top of housing, healthcare, living wage, and education, I think those are my top pressing issues, because for the first time, many people are now in the same boat of struggling and seeing our systems fail for the people who need the systems the most.
You know, you brought up education, and it occurs to me, and I've seen this thrown around, that Providence Public Schools came under state control, and now with the most probable Governor McKee in the future, and Governor McKee is a strong advocate for charter schools and such, that public schools might actually be more on a chopping block in Providence and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on the charter versus public and the other and all that? Where are you on that?
Yeah, I'm hoping that we start a charter moratorium. We do not need to invest in schools that are adjacent to the prison industrial complex. Charter schools treat our young Black and brown children as if they need to be robots in order to get a quality education. I'm a formerly low-income Black student who grew up in Georgia and South Carolina public schools. My family faced eviction. My mom worked paycheck to paycheck. She was unemployed. Sometimes we had the lights cut off. We had the water cut off. But I still had a great public education and was able to go to Brown University. And that wasn't because I was able to pull myself up by the bootstraps, but because there was a public safety net and because I lived close enough to wealthy neighbors that they paid for good quality public education for all of their kids. Yeah. And so Rhode Island really needs to start having the conversation about what does it mean to ensure that every single student has access to quality education. We need to bring in more teachers who represent and look like the students. We need to have a more robust program of education. We need to expand certification in the state. I myself was a certified teacher in Massachusetts. I could not teach in the state of Rhode Island. Certified high school math, bilingual, queer, Black, all of those identities. And Rhode Island would not take me as a teacher. I would have to get emergency certified. And so there's so many problems, and using my story as one, there's so many problems that can be addressed in public schools that aren't. Charter schools are just a band-aid to a larger problem. Every student will not be able to enter into a charter school. And I think it is unfair to families and children to tell them that the only way they will get a quality education is if they go to a school where they're in that school building for 9 hours a day, wearing a uniform, not speaking out of turn, learning how to track their teacher, and doing all the things to make them, quote unquote, college ready. I was college ready for a high-tier school, and that was all through public education, going to school for a normal amount of time and having teachers who looked like me.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that I really appreciate having you on, Senator Mack. She is our newly inaugurated senator here at District 6. If you want to follow her on the web, learn more about her, she's at tiaramackdistrict6.com. You can also follow her on Twitter. Her username is MacDistrict6, pretty easy to figure out there. And we're wishing you a lot of luck this year in the legislative session. I know it's kind of a weird situation because they're meeting at these new locations once a week, if that. And, you know, obviously with the pandemic going on, it's a totally different dynamic. It's kind of like, you know, this is your first session as senator, and it's a whole different. It's kind of like my son's in kindergarten right now, and it's a much different experience than he would have gotten outside of the pandemic, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, definitely. It's a lot of new things, but I'm all about breaking the rules. And when the rules don't quite exist, I think it's a lot easier to break them and establish new ways of doing things.
Nice.
Well, I like hearing that sort of stuff because for a long time, you know, the General Assembly operated under kind of a just do whatever leadership says kind of thing. And mm-hmm. we're excited to see legislators like yourself and others that have come aboard this year that have said, listen, you know what? We're not going to be polite. We're going to make demands. This is what our constituents want, and this is what we're going to deliver on. And you've been a big proponent of that. Guys, follow Tiara on Twitter. She's explosive and awesome on Twitter. And she spells it out. You know, she tells you, well, here's the problem, and here's what we need to do to fix it. And it's stuff like that that we can appreciate because a lot of politicians, a lot of civil servants will say something. It's a platitude. You know, we want to, you know, for example, give you access to health care. What does that mean? Give you access to health? Everyone has access. I have access to the road. I mean, you know, it's not really giving me anything. So it's nice to hear a legislator like yourself that understands people's pain points and gets right to it. And here's what we need to do to solve that. So I can appreciate that from a taxpayer's point of view and just seeing something different. You know, whether we agree or disagree on anything, it's nice to see that, you know, you believe in something and you're saying, this is what I'm doing and here's the problem I'm trying to solve.
Thank you, Tara. I hope more people are excited to have those difficult and fun conversations.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show, Tiara Mack. We really appreciate it. Thanks so much. And you have a lovely weekend, a lovely week, I should say.
No worries. Have a good one.
You too. Right. Take care. So that's Senator Tiara Mack. And again, whether you're a righty or a lefty, nobody can articulate pain points that people are feeling and solutions for them in the General Assembly better than her. She's one of the best, and she's new. So I'm really excited to have had her on, and we look forward to future conversations. I just want to conclude here that, you know, this police episode has been, I hope, educational to a lot of people. And it's important to understand that, you know, we see images and video on the news of police acting inappropriately, and we always used to think, oh, this is not happening here. It's not happening in Rhode Island. And I think that recent protests under the, you know, while Trump has been in office, have shown that that's clearly not the case. You know, the police that act certain ways in Portland or Minneapolis or whoever else, those same problems permeate right here in Providence and in other cities in Rhode Island. So if you want to look at an example, look at, like I said, a number of years ago when there was a police car in Providence was stolen, I believe. Oh, yeah. And there was a video on YouTube you could watch. It showed police chasing after, assume this cop car. And I counted 80, I think it was 82 state and Providence police officers chasing that car. 82.
It was the wrong car, and it was the wrong man inside that, and they shot him to death.
Yep. Yep. And not only that, like, just to take that whole horrible tragedy out for a second, why, from a financial point of view, from a fiscal point of view, why were 82 police officers allowed to chase that car? Okay. Not only is chasing dangerous, when you have 82 police officers who are clearly out for blood, okay, clearly out for blood, oh, they took our car, we'll show him, 82. And that's the problem, is that when there's no accountability, the police can just spend whatever money they want. They can blow it on dumb stuff that doesn't improve public safety and in fact, causes harm to public safety, as in that example.
Yep.
And these things are costing taxpayers like you and I hundreds of thousands of dollars in unnecessary expenditures, you know? You know, how many times have you seen a call for something irrelevant, not really important, or a traffic stop, routine traffic stop, and two or three more cop cars show up behind the one that pulled you over? Why? Why are there three? Why are there two or three more? They need backup. I mean, you know, and I'm white, and this has happened to me, so it's not like, you know, the perceived threat of a black person. That's not it. It's just, why are we wasting money here? Why are those police officers taking time out of their patrol to stop behind a car that's just been pulled over for speeding and is just going to get a ticket and that's the end of it? I don't get it. It's one of those things that really bothers, you know, someone who, you know, I appreciate paying taxes. Okay, I pay a lot in taxes, and that's fine. If the money's going to help people and provide good services and not being wasted, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with, you know, a tax rate being as high as it needs to be. But I think that, you know, overall, you know, it's time to give us our money back. I think that these police budgets are too high for what they need to be, for what would equal good public safety. And I think that it's time to give us our money back. You know, not this term defund the police. That's fine. It's a very popular term, but let's get more direct. Okay, we don't want to defund the police. We want our money back. We want our tax money back that we've spent on this unnecessary stuff. And that, whether it be the military budget, okay, which is $800 billion+ a year that just goes overseas and gets wasted on weapons to Boeing and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and all these other contractors that we don't need. We don't need any of this stuff. Nobody's trying to attack our country. Nobody's looking to start war with us. It's just money that's wasted. And
Trump supporters.
yes. Internally, we've got problems, yeah. But externally, not so much. But you've got just so much money wasted, and it's time to give the taxpayers their money back. That's just my opinion, but I think that there's a lot of people out there that agree with me that it's fine to spend money on police as long as it's necessary and it's going to something, to a good cause, and it's not being wasted on whether it be Humvees, okay? Humvees again, it comes from the military budget being so high. They have all these extra vehicles and weapons and whatnot that they don't need, and so they give it to the police. And the police, who do not have military training, unless they've actually been in the military prior to becoming an officer, they don't have the skills necessary to treat those weapons accordingly, like someone in the military would. You know, so the people in the military, by training, are much more restrained than police officers are. That's the way it's supposed to be anyway. I'm not in the military, so I couldn't tell you for sure if that's the practice. But needless to say, we can see with police that doesn't always seem to be the case. So, yeah. Steve, I've covered everything I want to cover today. I think we had a good episode. Like we promised, it's a feature-length movie length here. if there's nothing else to add, then I just wanted to encourage our listeners, if you want to support us, please visit our Patreon. Go to upriseri.com and at the very top, just click donate. We're entirely donation run. So your donations, our Patreons are what keeps us going. That money goes to pay Steve and Will and our reporters that are on the scene every day reporting on the news that you see on upriseri.com. We also, for the money we don't spend on our reporters, we spend on new equipment. And we've got some really nice equipment now. Our videos are now being produced in 1080p.
Yeah.
And the reason we didn't do 1080p before is not because our cameras didn't record in 1080p. It's because, you know, we had older computer equipment that just takes a long time to process these videos. And so with your generous donations over the past year, we've been able to upgrade the primary laptop that Steve uses and some of our other equipment, resulting in a much faster process for Steve and for everybody. And that allows us to do 1080p videos now. So going forward, beginning this week, or actually beginning last week, most of our YouTube videos now are in 1080p. Yeah, so you can look at them on your big screen TV and not wonder what all the pixelations are.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be a little better.
So thanks again for tuning in for our fourth episode. We always appreciate you guys listening. And for more on our reporting, visit upriseri.com. And of course, follow us on Facebook. Again, UpriseRI. And then on Twitter, guess what our username is on Twitter? Ironically, UpriseRI. We try to post different stuff on all of our social media. So if you are following us on Instagram, for example, but not Twitter and Facebook, follow us on all the networks because we post different things. We don't usually post the same stories on all of them because that's boring. And then if you follow us, you just see the same thing three times. And also, if you want updates on our stories when we post them, if you go to UpriseRI.com, you'll look at the very bottom of your screen. There'll be a red bell. If you click on that red bell, you can opt into notifications right on your browser of whenever we post a story. So we're not going to email you. We're not going to bug you. You'll just get a little pop-out notification whenever Steve posts a new story. And it's easy to unsubscribe if you find it's too annoying. You get too many stories, what have you. Just go and click that red bell again. And boom, that's it. You're off. So it's
you can
simple.
Never get too much uprise.
But you can never really get too much uprise.
It's impossible.
I mean, Steve is churning out stories like for what he has to do in terms of, you know, life events and everything else he's involved in. It's just amazing that he churns out the stories he does. And so I really look forward to 2021 reporting. We've got a General Assembly that's going to actually meet this time.
We'll see what happens. It could well happen.
Yeah.
It could also fall apart if everybody starts catching COVID.
I hope that's not the case.
I hope everyone's wearing their masks. It's one of those things. It's like they're building it and will it hold? And that's the real question, right? I mean, already like the House opened with like two members out with COVID and one out for maybe COVID, right? So three members weren't there, right? One of them was Fenton Fung, who replaced Mattiello. And as far as I know, she's still representative elect because she hasn't been officially sworn in.
That's true.
Right?
That's
I don't think she's actually been officially, they swore in everybody, but I don't think she has been sworn in. So she'll need to be sworn in when she shows up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. So that's it for this week. We'll see you again next week, Monday at 11 a.m. for the new episode of The Uprising. We'll probably have on some special guests, too. And we'll let you know this upcoming week who they are. In the meantime, visit our website, donate on Patreon, all that jazz. And we will see you next week. Take care, everyone.